Hello and welcome to Time with Pastor Otabel, our interactive discussion program that throws the light of scripture on the salient issues of life. My name is Albert Okran, welcoming you on behalf of Dr. and Mrs. Otabel. In the past couple of weeks, we've looked at the African church and it's getting very interesting as we go. And I am honored to welcome, leading the discussion today, Pastor Mensah Otabel. Pastor Otabel, thank you so much for these interactions.
Thank you.
There is great expectation for today's topic.
All right. We'll see how it goes.
Let me welcome Pastor Eric Hermeku of ICGC Open Heavens. Pastor Eric, good to see you.
Thank you very much, Reverend Albert.
And then Pastor Priscilla Nana Nketiah, ICGC Eagles Temple. Pastor Priscilla, good to see you.
Thank you, Pastor Albert.
Wonderful. Doc, we would like to zero in today on pastors or church leadership and start with succession planning. So in the next decade or two, plus or minus, many of the leading, the biggest African charismatic churches will experience their first leadership transition from the founders. How ready is the African charismatic church for a seamless transition or continuity? And what should be the big factors in this discussion about relevance beyond one generation?
I think church transition has always been one of those things people feel a bit nervous about. And it didn't start from today. I mean, from the early church, from the transition from the original apostles of Christ to the disciples of the apostles, people were not sure how Christianity would fare. If you even look at the leadership of Israel, from the generation that had been in the wilderness for 40 years with Moses and Joshua, who transitioned into the promised land, after that generation passes, people are nervous as to how transition and succession would be. And so I can imagine that people would be concerned about how churches would transition. This is the first time for most people to, in their lifetime, see a formation of a church. Most times, you know, churches would be in existence before you were born. And so we didn't see the days of Wesley, of Luther, of Calvin, of course not of some of the earlier church leaders. So we just can't figure out how these very prominent characters would transition their churches. I think they would do well. I think that as has been with the nature of the church, it will go through. And it will come out well.
You think we are ready?
Well, you know, ready or not, it will happen. And it will work out.
Doc,
it will work out.
For churches listening to you today, what should be some of the considerations that they should have in mind? Would it be structure? Will it be personnel? Will it be systems? What should be the big considerations? Will it be timing?
I think really, it is how quickly a church is ready to move from a person to an institution and when it should take place. Some wait till after the founder and then the institution kicks in. And some, whilst the founder is there, the concept of transition from personal decision-making to a systemic decision-making, that means that you have groups in the church that take over some of the responsibilities that are normally handled by just one person and his preferences or her preferences. So I think it's important that the process of transiting from a person to an institution starts intentionally and deliberately. And more the leader begins to take his hands or her hands off and allow things to grow in a more inclusive and collegial manner.
I like the word deliberate. It seems to be a very important word in this discussion.
Yes, it is.
So you said last week you entreated church leaders to invest in a stronger generation of pastors. And you raise success factors like adequate theological training, a thorough knowledge of church history, of contemporary ministry, and so on. What happens when a church does not have these foundations? It takes a while to build them up and has reached the time of transitioning.
Yeah, you know, many times when we think about transition, we're thinking of an individual handing over power. But transition goes beyond an individual handing over power to even philosophical transition, ministry concept transition. A founding transition is very different from an establishing and a building transition. The mindsets are very different. So part of the transition that has to take place is for a founder, so to speak, to realize that what was required to found the church may not necessarily be what is required to settle the church and make it grow. And I think that's where training comes in. God has a way of making his grace abound in our weaknesses. And you see that a lot in the beginnings of church movements. You would find God will pick somebody who probably has never been to school, but is divinely graced in a tremendous way. And God gives them compensatory gifts, as I call them, that where they are absent in knowledge, God gives them probably a word of knowledge. So they become prophetic, but they are really not educated. Now, sometimes we are then tempted to think that because this is how they've operated, this is how it should be. And we forget that it is God's compensation for a lack that the person has. And that at a certain point, we have to regularize the system, especially when it goes to the second and third generation. And that is why I feel that the raising of succeeding generations is very different from the raising of a founding generation. The training is very different because you are moving from more an informal system to a more formal system. Of course, you know, when most church leaders stay in office till they can't function any longer. And the people are okay with it because he's the one they know and they still want him to be there forever. But the next generation is not going to have the same luxury. They would have term limits and they'll be voted in power or voted out of power and so on. So we have to then shift the mindset to preparing people for that level of transition.
Doc, in biblical times and contemporary times, we have seen example of successful transitions where leaders and pastors transfer to their children. We have had the success of Aaron to Eliza, and in contemporary times, John Austin to Joel Austin. But in the case of Samuel and also Eli, their children didn't do very well. So if they are going to be transition for pastors to their children, how do they groom their children, and what does it take for them to get it right?
It's a very dicey situation because sometimes we compare wrongly. Because the priesthood of the Old Testament was hereditary. There was the Levitical tribe and then the priesthood family, the Aaronic family. So if you were in that family, you were going to be a priest under the Old Testament, and you'll be trained that way. And we have to also understand that much of the transitions and at that time were all based on the system of apprenticeship. So a son apprentices the father and takes on his trade. And it didn't only happen in the sacred order. It happened in everything else, in carpentry. The son will take over the father as a carpenter. The fisherman's son will take over because there was a certain predictability that you didn't change your profession. So if you became, you were a carpenter, it's carpenter transgenerationally. If you're a fisherman, fisherman transgenerationally, and so on. But so we cannot lift that system into today. First from the New Testamental concept where the priesthood is no longer hereditary. And it's not one that is passed on from a parent to the child. So to use the Old Testament system, I think would be a misjudging of the situation. But the question we should then ask is it possible for biological children to be in a succession plan for an organization? All things are possible. I don't like predictability that it should be. But when we say it's possible, it means that it's in the scheme of things, it can be one of the factors that can be looked at. We should also be able to understand the mindset of the church, especially from the one person or one local church arrangement and a denomination. They're two different things. So you cited the example of Joel Osteen. That's one church. But if his father had 100 churches, that would be a totally different arrangement from what would have persisted if he had only one church.
Doc, you open a very, very interesting dynamic with this break separating a local church from a denomination. Help us to appreciate the difference in the dynamic and how it will play out in terms of the quality of person or the level of preparation required for leadership in that kind of dynamic.
You see, the charismatic church, and that's one of the things I would want to really look at, historically developed from various church activities that took place in the 1940s in the United States, where individuals came out from denominations and founded individual ministries. That was when people would put their name on their ministry. So you have Oral Roberts ministry, Catherine Kuhlman ministry. So the whole organization was built on the gifting of one person. And everybody in the organization serves that one person because that is the only gift that is in operation and it's in manifestation. So we had these, whether it's Morisurillo or it was just one person and his ministry. It's a very, very narrow organizational system. It doesn't have the capacity to bring in others. Because if you had one person who is an evangelist and you have 10 now, so whose ministry is it going to be? So it is a system that is very linear and only works in a very narrow, constrained system. Unfortunately, that system that regulated ministries, whether it's an evangelistic ministry or healing ministry, now transitioned into a church. And one of the things about a church, even a local church, it's a bigger organization than a one ministry. Then in a church, you have multiple pastors. At that point, the system that regulates a ministry doesn't work in the church because different stakeholders have come in. All right. But it's still an easier thing because it's one church. So you may have one senior pastor, 3-4 associate pastors, and its transition is very, very different. But when it transitions into a denomination where you have then about 100, 200, 300 pastors, and to think that only one person's ministry is important, you are actually working philosophically with a ministry system that has been conditioned for only a ministry, but not for a church. And what I see is a lot of churches are still running the system. I call it a juvenile system. It's a it's a childhood system of organization of spiritual ministries. It happened years ago for people to just run one ministry. It is not suited for a denomination, and neither is it suited even for a local church. Once you make it work that way, you're going to have friction. And that's why the charismatics unfortunately have so much breakaways, because the system they are operating philosophically only accommodates one person.
So, Doc, while it may not have the name, the one person's name on it, you're saying that it may have a neutral name, but it has all the elements.
Yeah, it may be called International Central Gospel Church or International Transcontinental Church, but philosophically and structurally, it is a one-person ministry. Decision-making is centralized in one person, his or her preferences. That's always what happens. Whereas if you want to build a church, then you have to broaden the base so that other people find their space to operate in within that church.
I think the distinction you are drawing is very critical, where we are just looking at a personality, and then we are looking at a church that's a denomination, many branches. It brings me to a question George Abedu is asking from La. He says he knows that you're a generational thinker and have a succession plan for ICGC. So can you share with us how ICGC will look like in your absence?
I mean, nobody knows what anything would look like in their absence. What you try to do is to move from a personality to a system. So anybody who is in the ICGC system, especially the pastors, know that it is generally a committee-run organization. So we have various committees for almost everything that happens, and the committees meet and they deliberate and they come up with policies and so on. And, you know, everything goes through a system instead of a person dictating what needs to be done. So that is transition. So it is devolution of decision making from one person to probably 400 people who are in various groups and committees, denomination wide, are making these decisions, whether it has to do with licensing of pastors or ordination training. Everything is broadly discussed and implemented.
Right. So this is time with Pastor Otabolu. We are having a discussion about the African church, and we are looking at succession planning. We'll go for a brief break. When we come back, we will shift our attention to the very beginnings, the calling of pastors, selection of pastors. If you have a pastor friend, somebody you love and appreciate, who's not listening to this broadcast, find them somewhere, text them, WhatsApp them, or invite your friends and loved ones to join us in this important discussion. Please don't go away. Welcome back to Time with Pastor Otabolu, an exciting discussion about the African church. And today we are looking at leadership, at pastors. Doc, many pastors and founders in your generation started ministry at a very, very young age. And it's very heartwarming to look around at the number of general overseers in their mid or early 60s, suggesting that they all started at a particular time. How do we replicate that level of success at a time when it would seem that a pastor who is in his mid-20s is considered too young to think big or dream big?
I don't know who considers a pastor in their 20s too young to dream big and think big. Generational works are very, very unique. For example, if you look at the independent struggle for Ghana And as I said, I'd always try to look at the bigger picture. And for Africa, if you look at the ages of the people who were in the struggle, some of the leaders were in their 30s, fighting for their nations to be free. If you look at the civil rights movement, for example, Martin Luther King started at 26 years. And currently, a 26-year African-American will struggle to become such a major national leader. But in a space of emptiness, where there is nothing, and nothing has occurred, a young person, even 23, 21, can become a major world leader or major thought leader, major influencer. But after systems have been built, then the process of climbing to the top becomes a bit longer. And that is what it is. When there were no churches like ours, a 23-year-old, 22-year-old could start. But after those have come, if you're 23 years old, your process to the top now is longer, and you have to climb longer to get to the top. And so although potentially you could do what was done maybe 40 years ago by people your age, but because of the structure and the system they have created, getting to the top becomes a bit tougher, you know. So that's how it works out.
It would seem that in the legal fraternity, for instance, before you become a Supreme Court judge, you will probably be close to your retirement. From what you just described, isn't the church running the likelihood that, I wouldn't say the risk, the likelihood that for people to get to the place that we are describing, the decision-making level, at the very highest level, they probably will be ending up at around the time when they are at the twilight of their careers?
Yeah, well, maybe. But you see, when we started, we didn't start by overseeing 1,000 churches. We started in a classroom. So commensurate with our age and experience, we were able to handle that. The people who are taking over from us are not going to pastor 20 people in a classroom. They're going to pastor a very complex organization. And so they require far more experience than I was required to start, because I started very small. Those who are coming in are starting very big. It's like when you get transferred to go and pastor a church. Somebody has been there. Maybe the church was in a classroom. They've now built. They have maybe a 500-seat auditorium, and they have so much. And you are a young pastor, 26. You've just been posted to take over. Yes, your age qualifies you to be a pastor, but you also realize that experientially, you lag behind, because you go and meet people who are older than you, more practical sense than you, they've been married longer than you've been alive. whereas the same 26-year-old, if he went to start a fresh church, he will find his capacity very appropriate for what he's doing. If he's taking over an already established church, so much will be required from him. And he has to note that he's taking over something way bigger than his capacity at that time.
Very interesting, Doug.
Yeah, it seems as if young people will have to learn a lot also about the sacrifices that leaders ahead of them have made.
That is part of it. But you see, the knowledge I have now and running ICGC, if somebody is taking over from, must have the knowledge I have now. Now, let's say I took 40 years to acquire what my knowledge now. That person has to find the shortest possible way to get this knowledge and be able to run as complex an organization as I'm running now. And that is why you have to, and one way to shorten the learning curve is to formalize the learning. So if he's going to do, start, let's say somebody starts and still seminary training at age 18, goes to do 6 years, gets his master's degree, that takes him to about 24, 25. He does another 5 years, gets a PhD, he's 30. By that time, theologically, conceptually, he's acquired a lot more to be able to lead, even from a theological point of view. Whereas I had to take so long to get it, he can take a far shorter time to get it.
It looks as if the first generation charismatic leaders sacrificed formal education to be able to respond to the call. And then you have young people who want to abandon the education because they have fire in their boots.
Because people see leading a church only from a singular point of view, preaching. But about 90 or more percent of what I do is not preaching. You know, so you're dealing with all kinds of stuff, all kinds of stuff. So if you see preaching only as the work of the pastor, then you would miss it. Probably about 5% of his job is preaching, but the rest of it is very, very management, administration, overseeing. I mean, so many activities that require a vast breadth of knowledge.
Right. When Prophet Samuel was sent by God to go and anoint David, he nearly made a mistake. So what are the attributes, skills, and competencies that a young pastor should have or a leader should have to be able to identify somebody coming up? And what are the warning signs that must be avoided?
It's always difficult. I mean, Samuel was helped by God. Otherwise, he was going to choose the wrong person. So that tells you that the first impulse at whom you think has potential could actually be very wrong. Usually people prove themselves. You could identify potential, but you have to then put the potential in the fire. That means if I think you have potential, I have to help you to grow the potential by putting you in a system where you have to use the potential. So I don't protect the potential. I have to challenge the potential. And then you would know what the material the person is made out of. Because if you think something is gold, how do you prove it's gold? You put it in fire. If it comes out better, you know it's gold. If it burns, it wasn't gold. So part of the job of every leader is to look for talent. But you don't look for talent just to raise it. You look for talent and challenge it. And it is in that challenge that you see who has the real stuff and who doesn't have it.
That means that it's very advisable that as young pastors, we must be ready to start from where we are than to aspire for huge God spaces and all that. Because like you said, you started very small and you grew with it. And the tendency now is that people want to start ministry, but they want to have it very big in a short time.
Ambition is good. We must encourage ambition. But ambition doesn't get anything done. You have to go through the fire to get it done. So I like it when people say they're going to do great things, and God has called them and they're going to do mighty things. There has to be a dreamer. But that by itself is not going to make them do great things. They have to get used to the idea that they'll go through the rough and tumble of life. And sometimes, you know, people think they can do great things, and then you put them in a situation and their mind changes. We see it all the time when people come up from Bible college and they're very fired up. Pastor Prisla was head of our Bible college for a while. Mm-hmm. And they're very fired. And you put them into a situation to go and start a church somewhere, and they understand that you know, motivating yourself in a classroom is very different from making sure that the goats and the chickens don't come into your church meeting room whilst you're meeting in that small classroom, and that you stand at the door to welcome everybody, and you go to clean up your place, your church room, and do all this hard work that you probably didn't associate with the work of a pastor. But you find out that when you start, you become the chief laborer in the church. You do everything in order to build the church and make it work.
Doc, you describe the word with the word fire,
mm-hmm.
the grooming process mm-hmm. that a senior puts a younger person through. How do you reconcile the fact that you love the person and yet you are putting them through what you describe as fire? And I'm sure that from the young person's perspective, it will almost seem like they are being punished or they are even disliked when they are going through that process. I suspect so.
It happens in every profession. It happens everywhere. It happens even with parenting. When you want your children to get good grades, you take them through fire. They learn, and you put them, give them assignments, and you give them discipline, and you shut the TV off, and they're crying and think you hate them. But one day, hopefully, when they are about 40 years, they will say, thank you for shutting the TV off and making me run. And it's the same thing with when you're raising a leader. You're not doing it to damage the person. But if you truly believe potential, then you will not shy challenging the person. And if you really believe that you have the potential, then you have to face the fire and come out as pure gold. Because the end, you must come out as pure gold.
Doc, so based on what you just described, you mentioned Samuel.
Mm.
He went through the fire under Eli.
Mm-hmm.
Elisha went through the fire under Elijah. Paul says he was trained by Gamaliel very strictly.
Mm.
How critical is the role of a mentor or a senior overseeing the young person in the developmental process? And then where does that leave the John the Baptist who probably was in the wilderness with no mentor?
You know, I'm very flexible with these issues because I recognize sovereignty, God's sovereignty in the affairs of men. People would say that everybody must have a spiritual father. I don't hold that view. That if you don't have a father, then you can't do something. I don't hold that view. I think we limit God to human performance. It's good to have somebody watching over you and mentoring you and correcting you. Sometimes too much of that can also smother you, where you are overprotected from doing daring things. It has its value. In the end, from my point of view, the person determines the outcome of his life. So if I'm a pastor, I determine the kind of pastor I'm going to be. Not the person who oversees me. They can guide me. They can instruct me. They can lay a path for me. They can create opportunity for me. They can open doors for me. But in the end, I make all the big decisions about my life. So mentoring is good, whether formal or informal. But what if nobody mentors you? What are you going to do? I mean, nobody fathers you. You know, when I was growing up as a Christian, I never had a spiritual father. People ask me, who's your spiritual father? None. I never had anybody who believed in me. I never had anybody who encouraged me. I cannot pick one person from my ministry formation who I'd say believed in me and thought I would become something useful. I can't pick one person. Did it stop me? No. So sometimes you're going to be in a situation where nobody really encourages you. You encourage yourself in the Lord. Nobody teaches you, teach yourself. Nobody helps you, help yourself. So, but should you get somebody? I mean, for example, if you're a pastor and you are in a church like ICGC, you're going to have tons of trainers and mentors. You go through a formal training. The system itself protects you, gives you resources, gives you tools to learn with and to practice with and so much. Yes, and it's all good. But granting you are in ICGC and you are posted to a far off place and your area supervisor is miles away from you, and let's say the area supervisor doesn't really like you, which happens. What are you going to do? Cry and say, why have they posted me to the place? You just see the best way to make it work. So I don't like overvaluing these things about spiritual fathers and mentors and all of that. They're good if they are there. But if they are not there, God is our Father. The Holy Spirit is our teacher. Trust Him and move on.
Okay, I mean, practical way of looking at these things that is so, so amazing. Thank you.
Now, can we look at more structured training? You founded Daniel Institute to deliberately train young Christian professionals with strong values to hold responsible positions in society and in the church. How important is this approach for the African church?
It's important, and the training should be very rigorous. I feel we shouldn't give people shabby training. And I always said, if you give a doctor shabby training, the patients are going to suffer. If you give a lawyer shabby training, clients are going to suffer. And if we give pastors shabby training, this glorified Sunday school, just, you know, okay, I mean, you just look at the training, you wonder, who put this curriculum together? I mean, will this pass a rigorous assessment? And what we try to do is to conceptualize a training program that is as rigorous as the counterpart of the pastor in a profession. So what is rigorous for a brain surgeon to get his qualification should be what you are putting into your pastors to become top-class pastors wherever they are. So we shouldn't cheapen training at all. It's going to be hard. It's going to be rigorous. It's going to be mentally challenging, spiritually challenging. But in the end, it equips the pastor to be excellent and to be effective, because we handle human lives and we have to be adept at doing that.
Right. Paul writing to Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 1 to 2 to 12, he listed a couple of things. A bishop should be blameless, husband of one wife, and all those things. Are these things provided for the people to be self-regulatory, or it is a marking scheme for pastors?
I think it's both. I think it's a way by which we can assess ourselves. But also, if you belong to a church denomination, then it becomes basis for assessment. So yes, it works that way. I believe they are very important indicators of the kind of values we should hold as pastors, from our homes to the pulpit, to handling older people, to handling younger people. I mean, Paul enumerates all of that, and it just gives you the impression that the publics of the pastor is very wide. And this is just within the church. And then the church is within the community and has to relate to the community. So the pastor must then be equipped to do all of that. So, yes, maybe it should be a personal regulatory system. But if you belong to a church organization, then they will use it as a marking scheme to mark you, yes.
This is time with Pastor Otago. Very interesting discussion about the African church. And today we are looking at pastors. We are looking at the calling, the preparation, the requirements. And we just talked about regulation. When we come back, we'll talk a bit more about regulation and then also bring on board your questions about the African church. Please don't go away. Welcome back to Time with Pastor Otabo, an enthralling discussion about the African church. Pastor Otabo, before we went for the break, at a point you made a very interesting illustration that the requirements for the pastor's contemporary in, let's say, brain surgery must be superimposed on the curriculum of the pastor. Many of these professions have regulatory bodies that govern their actions and sanction errant members. Would you subscribe to the idea of some kind of regulation for pastoral behavior?
Most of these organizations or professions will have internal self-regulatory programs, whether it's architects or journalists or some other profession. And I think pastors need that. And they do have that for those who are in larger organizations. So if somebody is a pastor in ICGC, for example, or Assemblies of God or Church of Pentecost, they will be regulated. And there are rules that they abide by. And most churches do pastoral assessment of their pastors every year. And they talk through all the problems and observations and areas of improvement. And of course, if something is done that is ethically wrong within the fraternity, it will be brought to the attention of the person. So in individual denominations, I'm sure if in the Methodist Church, Presbyterian Church, these things will go on. But church-wide, as trans-denominational, there's nothing like that. Because, you know, it's different organizations and the expectations are a little different from each other.
I think that the challenge sometimes happens when, especially in a media-driven ministry environment, you watch a pastor who may not be necessarily under any denominational authority do things that you will see cross the line or cross the boundary, and people ask, who's checking, who's holding them accountable? And that seems to be the challenge with
them. Yeah, I'm sure if there's a freelance journalist, nobody will regulate him if he doesn't belong to an association. I mean, some professions require, regulated by law. I don't think that the work of the clergy should be regulated by law, but they should be regulated internally by their denominations.
I think that we probably also have to look at selection of leaders. When we look in the scripture, the methods vary. What is the New Testament position on leadership selection? Is it by voting? Is it by lots? Is it by consensus? Is it by dropping a mantle? Or is it by inheritance?
I think every organization has to determine its processes. In ICGC, we have a constitution, and the process is clearly laid out in the constitution as to how leadership will be selected. That may not be how another church will select leaders. So it has to be clarified. I mean, I think it's important as an organization grows that we don't leave shady areas. You know, there should be clarity. If somebody is a young pastor, he should know this is the pathway. This is the pipeline. If I follow this path, I will get there. You know, there should be predictability. It shouldn't be the favor of a person to make you or unmake you. It should be the merit you show in your work that gets you there. So I'm not going to fuss over whether it's election or lot or putting a mantle. If people think that they would throw mantles on people to determine leadership, then who knows, maybe it works for them. It wouldn't work for me. I think that it has to be merit.
Many admire your partnership with Lady Joy. Mm-hmm. She've always said that she's a pillar in your ministry. What is the ideal of a pastor's spouse in the church?
Well, I mean, primarily she's my wife, but beyond that, she's in the ICGC hierarchy. She doesn't have an official role. She has, that means the governmental role, but she has responsibilities for organizing events, and she is a phenomenal organizer. But when we married, I didn't marry her because I thought she'd be an organizer. I just saw her, I liked her, and I married her. And later realized that there are things that she can do to help all of us in the work that we do. A pastor's wife is first and foremost a wife. And so she must be able to get on well with the husband, you know, or vice versa. If the pastor is a woman, get on well with a whatever, vice versa. So I think that role should be clear, that we're not creating a ministry partnership. You're creating a home partnership. But you may discover values that can help ministry, but that's not the basis of the marriage. The basis of the marriage is a partnership at home. And if out of it something comes that can benefit the ministry, that's fine. Pastors and their spouses should endeavor to build a cohesion between them, just the two of them, before we even include the larger organization.
Doug, there are cases where some pastors' wives feel that they are also called into ministry. So how does the pastor manage that?
Well, I mean, I think marriage is noble, but I don't know whether it's a calling. You don't get called by proximity to a person. So I have siblings, I have brothers and sister, and they are not called because I'm called. If they are working for God, then they are called in their own right. So the pastor's wife, because of the nature of a church, becomes active in the church. Because of the nature of it has nothing to do with calling. It has to do with service and responsibility. Because people are going to call you a soft mommy. People will come to you with their problems. They're going to get engaged. They want you to go. They're going to get married. They want you to be there. Things like that. Yeah. So by just being associated with a pastor, it's almost like buy one, get one free. The church hires one and get the other one free. So the pastor's wife traditionally then plays some roles. Not everybody is suited to those roles, yeah. And they can define their role as they understand themselves better. But they are drafted more or less into the ministry.
This is time with Pastor Otable, a very, very insightful discussion about the African church. Let's go now to the box and bring out the questions you've been sending to Pastor Otable, and there are so many of them. Let's start with Kweku Adebri from Usu, who says, reference symbolic acts. How does Pastor Otable explain the breaking of the bread and giving thanks in administering Holy Communion? How different is that from putting a bit of the meal on the ground in the African culture, as you explained earlier? Aren't we also picking the culture of the Israelites at the time of Jesus? That's a good question.
Well, you know, Christianity is about Christ. And Christ says, do this in remembrance of me. So we do it. I mean, we follow the tradition of Christ. And if Christ says something, we do it. That is it. But our primary leader is Christ. And where his will conflicts with others, we choose Christ.
Charles McCarthy, he says, concerning Sunday schools, please don't you think we have to move from telling stories to teach some biblical doctrine to build our children for a future takeover?
I mean, there's value in that, but the way of teaching children is very different from the way of teaching adults. And you teach children primarily with stories, and out of the stories you weave lessons. You can't go and teach them hard information. That's why their books have a lot of pictures. And that's why they watch a lot of cartoon, because you break down their lessons in an age-appropriate way for them to learn. So it depends on the age that the person is talking about. But I think telling children stories and getting them to understand the lessons in the story is age-appropriate for them.
I think he's looking at the content being geared towards preparing them.
Well, you know, people will become effective at the right age. I mean, you don't say because somebody is going to go to the university to start teaching him university when he's a child. You teach him A, B, C, D, A is for apple, B is for ball. And then over time, they use those same tools to get to that level. So we shouldn't push it too much. Let kids be kids. Let's not force our kids to be adults too quickly.
Right. Daniel Kweku, that scene from London says that Dr. Mesa Otabo, please address the issue of curses when there's a breakaway.
When there's a breakaway,
yeah.
Somebody leaves a church,
yeah.
And what happens?
Maybe the senior pastor or the rains curses. That's what I think.
First of all, I've never cursed anybody.
I know that.
Under any circumstance. So that's all I can say. I don't get it. I mean, if somebody has left, let them go and move on. And hopefully wish that they do well. And if they don't do well, that they will find their way back and be nurtured.
Prince Ramsey says, Pastor Sabo, can you kindly share with us your biggest successes, failures, or regrets in ministry and some advice for younger pastors based on that?
That's about three programs in all. So. I don't really know what my successes are. I don't really group things in that way in my mind. You know, what I try to do is just do what I must do and not look back. So generally as a person, I'm not fixated on myself or on what I do or what people consider my success. It's not in my radar at all. I'm constantly thinking of what must I do now? What's the next thing I must do? So, that's how I see it. That's my worldview.
Well, I think viewers would want you to share a bit of your regrets and maybe some challenges you encountered along the way.
I don't really look at life that way. You know, I don't look at life in challenges. I just face whatever comes my way and move on. You know, so I don't have these melodramatic, this is a hard thing and it came and I almost died. You know, nothing gets me to that point. I just move on.
But that's something to learn from.
All right. So that maybe we can have a program to look at that. But I think you need strong mental focus in life and stop being easily ruffled by what happens around you, because life will give you ruffles. It's that's what the planet is for. It's to give you tough times, but you have to overcome them.
All right, Kofi Asare from Dasma said that, which is your preferred theology, a Calvinist or an Arminian?
Jesus Christ.
I like that.
Jesus Christ. I think we could discuss those finer points another time, but I appreciate Calvinist positions in a lot of ways.
All right.
Pastor President, let me give you the last question for today.
Okay. So Edmund Agbesi from Sugarcopy says, Dr. Utabera, how can the African churches be cleansed from these idol-associated acts? I want to read it so I don't miss one.
Okay.
Very interesting. Like consultation fees, using of tokens like handkerchiefs, anointing oil, holy water, and praying at a particular altar by invocation, etc.
We must go back to Jesus. Trust in his name. Follow him. Follow his teachings. And do the best to make Christ manifest in our lives. I appreciate why people do that. I understand, because they're trying to connect people to what they are familiar with. And they know that if you give the African nothing, then they can't exercise faith. So you have to give them something, a token to believe in. But that also keeps them at a very rudimentary level of their spirituality. And they never grow. So we have to wean people off these placeholders and begin to exercise our faith in Christ more robustly.
Taking us to a higher level of our thinking in terms of these issues that we have discussed. So permit me to give you a bonus question from South Africa.
Yes.
From Mothio, who says, why are African pastors so obsessed with power and honor? I've witnessed it time and time again where there's a blurred line between idolatry and honor between pastors and their congregations. Dr. Mothio, please.
I don't know whether it's African pastors. I think human beings generally are like that. And I also think there are African pastors who are not like that. So there's a certain overgeneralization of what we see as the same everywhere. Leaders want honor. And it's across board in every culture. If you go to Japan, there's a lot of honor for leadership. Go to China, Asian countries, go to Middle Eastern countries, there's a lot of honor for leadership. You go to South America, the only place where you see this honor being diminished is current Europe. And I say current Europe because that's not how Europe has always been. So it's a certain human response to people that we see are in positions of power or leadership. I think we can also become obsessed with it, where its trappings become the most visible marks of our leadership. And I think if that your leadership is just marked by that, then we need to revise our approach to leadership. Yes, I think so. I think so. I mean, you see, there is a balance, and sometimes my observation is we tilt from one end to the other, and we never see the balance in how to weight all of these things well. So people say, well, don't honor anybody. We're all the same. It's not true. And then somebody says, I'm the man of God and I'm the only one you honor, you know, and so you find two extremes, and it looks like human beings like polemics. We always like to be in two extremes and hit the extremes at each other. And we don't know how to marry the different poles and get a more concise, more rounded, a more developed approach to what we are doing. So, My hope in what I'm doing is try to get people to move from the polemics to start thinking that it's not always about the extremes, that there is a way in which we can navigate our path sensibly on all levels, as pastors and as individuals.
Concise, rounded, and developed. That's how next week's edition of Time with Pastor Table is going to be. Invite somebody, invite a friend, invite a loved one to join us next week for another huge conversation as we continue to explore the African church. A big thank you to you, Pastor Table, for the insights you've shared. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Pastor Eric. It's been awesome.
Very, very insightful.
Absolutely amazing.
Very insightful.
Pastor Priscilla.
Thank you so much.
We've enjoyed ourselves, haven't we?
Yes, it's always a learning experience for me.
Doc, take us home with your closing thoughts.
Well, you know, we've said so much. I'm a pastor myself. I've been for quite a while. And I understand pastors, especially the emerging pastors from Africa, those who have emerged in the last 40 years. I understand the world that has produced us. And I understand the belief system that has produced us and the philosophy that has produced us. Some for good, some not for good. And my hope, if you're listening to me and you're a pastor, is that you take time with yourself to understand yourself better and the world that has produced you a little better, and start doing some introspection and self-examination to look at areas that you need some amendments and some reworking. And I think if we go on this journey of constantly working on ourselves, we will be far better than we are at the end of the day. So I pray for every pastor who is listening to me. You have a tough job. May the Lord give you grace. May he give you wisdom. May he give you ability to handle your human relationships, to handle your institution, to handle all the important decisions that have to be made. May God give you the courage to do what is difficult to do. May God give you the wisdom to decipher into all those difficult choices you have to make. And in the end, may Christ be glorified in your life and in your ministry. In Jesus' name, amen.